Hello and welcome to Dialect. Welcome to Dialect for the week beginning Sunday, the 17th of June, 2012. I'm John Peters Coleman, and this week, in our final retrospective on the Battle of the Beanfield, where travellers were beaten up and had their vehicles wrecked by Wiltshire police in June 1985, we hear how the 80s counterculture relates to the modern Occupy movement from investigative journalist Andy Worthington. I speak to two people also involved in town twinning, specifically the Bristol-Tbilisi link and the Bristol-Hanover link. We also have some poetry from Rose Redun and some music and some lyrics by Tim Burrows. And we also have Alia Lighton. She is interviewing Gorgonzola in this week's Sofa Session. We also have a What's On Guide and a Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks. Dialect is produced by volunteers and will broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2 and on Swindon FM and also on Preston FM. We'll also go out on St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. Dialect recommends volunteer-run Bristol Bullywatch Helpline. It's aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318 753 and we'll have a reminder of the phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bullywatch at the end of the show. It was 18 years ago this month that hundreds of travellers in their coaches, lorries and other vehicles were forced by the police off the road, on the way to the Stonehenge Free Festival no less, and told to park up in a West Country field. It was the decade of Thatcherism, the 80s, and the Tory Prime Minister had vowed to break the unions and the travellers. What happened next goes down in history alongside the miners' strike the year before and the Wapping printers' strike the year after. The so-called Battle of the Beanfield took place on 1st of June 1985, just off the A303 in Wiltshire. But the convoy of hundreds of travellers in their living vehicles represented genuine freedom and Britain's counterculture. The Battle of the Beanfield set the scene for the development of Britain's counterculture, which has appeared most recently as the Occupy movement, as author of the definitive book on the battle to break the back of England's traveller movement, Andy Worthington, explained to Dialect's Tony Gosling.
I'm Andy Worthington. I'm a freelance investigative journalist, author, filmmaker. The main thing of the government that we've got is that they're actually trying to persuade us all that we can't afford to have a state and that a state is a bad thing. The state provision of anything is a bad thing, that everything should be privatized, which I think is so extreme. It surprises me that more people aren't incredibly angry about it. It goes so far beyond what anyone has ever considered practical or feasible or right in the past, even though obviously the history of it is something that started particularly with Margaret Thatcher and was carried on by John Major and was carried on by the Labour government. So we've got this continuum of 33 years of this mentality, but these people have taken it so far. The joke that we've got is the Big Society, of David Cameron's Big Society, but as people picked up that one quite easily, when people were losing their jobs, then the joke would be, I've joined the Big Society. The Big Society means government providing nothing to the people. It means fending for yourself. Now, if as a backlash to this government, people do realise that it is up to them to organise themselves, because we have a government that is deliberately strangling the state provision of services, then that would be a good thing. What I just can't really get my head around is how they're getting away with some of the lies, which is the illusion that there is no money, as though all the taxpayers of this country have suddenly disappeared, and the government isn't, in fact, taking in all this revenue from people, but is pretending that there isn't any. It's just part of the manipulation that's going on. I think these people lie more incessantly than I've seen politicians do before. And unfortunately, they can't even do their sums. So a lot of the destructive things that they're doing are actually going to cost more in the long run to clean up. But at the moment, maybe that is one of the positive things that people can take, is we better start learning how to organise ourselves, because these people are out to do us in.
Now, we've also got the conventional sort of political system, and the main political parties all seem to be pretty much aligned with cuts at the moment, and particularly the Labour Party under Ed Miliband. Many people are sort of throwing up their hands and saying, well, you know, you've got a natural vote there for anybody that's unhappy with the close down of state provision will be voting for you, but you're actually alongside this policy of the shutdown of state provision, really. What about things like the Galloway effect up in Bradford? Because, I mean, he talked about that as the Bradford Spring, didn't he?
George Galloway is a unique individual, and how he can attract voters is probably not something that could be extended to a party. It's very disappointing with Labour that Ed Miliband, who has bothered to find out what the left wing of the Labour Party thinks, that's certainly more than Tony Blair ever did. But, you know, the management of the party appears to be like a rabbit in the headlights since the global crash of 2008, that they don't know what to do. They've got a government that is pushing austerity as the only game in town, which people are seeing through, but there isn't a political alternative of a major political party saying this is a cause for us to rethink how we do business.
So if democratic politics is hitting the buffers, where do you think the future lies?
We're in the throes of something that might bring about a new political movement, but it hasn't emerged yet. You know, we've so absolutely hit the buffers in terms of all the parties having become closer and closer together, no longer representing the interests of the people, no longer even having those ideological discussions about what it might mean, just essentially in the service of big business, either very actively or as a default position of, well, we've got to keep the money-making mechanisms operating, not caring about the people. I don't know whether any of them can see a way out of this. I mean, it is disappointing that the Labour Party doesn't understand that when, for example, the Tories are passing legislation so that now, if you're disabled but your partner earns £7,500 a year, you will get no support from the government. So £7,500 a year? That was an opportunity for any opposition party the next day to say, this is outrageous. We will set a, you know, pick a figure, 20,000, 25, 30. We will set a limit that's reasonable for somebody to earn before they're not getting any support for their disabled partner. But they didn't. They're not, that's what I mean. They appear to be like a rabbit in the headlights. They're paralyzed. The old model doesn't work anymore. The old model of gratifying the money markets led to the world being bankrupted in 2008, led to the most colossal crime taking place for which no one has been punished. And it's that people aren't thinking about. I don't know where a new movement comes from, Tony. When we first started this orgy of outsourcing, which really began big scale in the late 80s, I immediately thought, this isn't going to work. If Chinese people do all the manufacturing, what the hell are the people in our countries going to do? We must be creating what eventually will be a tsunami of unemployment. And look where we're at.
I wonder, though, whether society doesn't have some of its own sort of almost natural healing methods, and that possibly, I mean, there's massive numbers of young people who are very articulate. They do understand that the system's broken and that they're expressing themselves to a certain extent through the Occupy movement. I mean, do you think that's still got some way to run?
Yeah, I hope it has. I mean, you know, obviously the taking public squares and public spaces and then essentially being evicted means, you know, phase one is over. What happens next? I don't know. That's why I'm very interested, because I think we have to be back to those old discussion points of property and land, that those have to be taken by people who can then organize themselves from the ground up. I mean, you know, the problem with the kind of hysterically high standard of living that's required at so many levels in this country is how hard it is to start something if you don't have any money. Well, why should it be that way? There are many things that you can do from the ground upwards. You just need to remove all those obstacles to it, all those, you know, insane rents and business charges that people get when they try and start something off. So that, you know, that needs tackling. I mean, this is you know, a persistent story through my time as an adult, is governments actively working for corporate interests and not for individuals or for small businesses. Tony Blair made that explicit from the beginning, that he was only interested in corporations. He wasn't interested in individuals and small-scale entrepreneurs. But to me, those are actually, in this kind of post-industrial sense, these are the people that we need to find ways to encourage to be able to make a living. Is the one of the great things that we have in the West is the creativity of young people.
Whilst those young people are very creative, and lots of them have got no job opportunities, there's a lot of space opening up, isn't there, of derelict and empty commercial properties.
Yeah.
This is something which certainly, you know, we've seen in Bristol. Quite a lot of those are now being taken over by youngsters and stuff's being done with them.
Yeah, well, that's great. I mean, I hope there will be more of it. I mean, I just think it probably needs to be conceived of more in a way of trying to get political acceptance for that, and also trying to get a certain amount of non-profit financial backing on the basis that this shouldn't be illegal. What's been happening up to now is what should have been illegal, making it almost impossible for people to get a start in life. Because, you know, I'm not a young person anymore, but I'm able to step back from it and look at the fact that older people have been enriching themselves at the expense of younger people for quite some time, and that's just going on and on, and that is unfair. So, you know, what can constructively be done, not just so that young people are trying to take what they need by occupying spaces and trying to start something on their own terms, but how we could construct something that would actually enable people to do this.
Thank you to Andy Worthington there, author of the illustrated book The Battle of the Beanfield, talking to Dalek's Tony Gosling about the fallout from the Thatcher government's attack on hundreds of travellers in their live-in vehicles while travelling to the Stonehenge Free Festival on the 1st of June 1985. A pleasure to introduce Tony Gosling. Hello.
Hi, John.
You're usually behind the microphone producing like a mastermind, but you are here in front of the microphone. You've recently met a man. Who is he?
Well, that is Kevin Cahill, but really it kind of follows on from what we've just heard about the Battle of the Beanfield and Andy Worthington, who I spoke to there, because Andy, he has been following this whole sort of counterculture for years, and his book, The Battle of the Beanfield, really got me thinking about, you know, what is it about our counterculture and the fights between the police and the counterculture that sort of defines it, really. And Kevin Cahill's kind of done a very, very good, I think, explanation. And that is simply what Andy was saying there, which is about land ownership. And it's the fact that we've got such a very, very badly distributed land ownership. In other words, there's something like 2/3 of the population with no land at all. Mm. And yet there is a tiny 0.01% of the population who own hundreds of thousands of acres and have done since the Norman invasion. So, you know, if we can start sharing this land out a bit, quite clearly, you know, things are going to get better in Britain.
Okay. So he sounds like a very knowledgeable chap. How much research has he done into what must surely be an epic task?
It is. It's an incredible task. And the thing that makes it so difficult is that you might think, well, you can go down to the land registry. There's one in the centre of Gloucester, for example, a regional one, and find out who owns the land. Well, you can't, because land has only been registered legally. You only had to have registered land in the last 50 years or so.
Right.
And that was only when land is changing hands. So a lot of this land, which is, goes back literally to the medieval times, the Middle Ages, has never changed hands. Okay, so it's not been registered. You can't go down to the land registry and say, and who owns this piece of land? So, because something like 3/4 of the land in Britain has never changed hands for hundreds of years.
Right. So how on earth did Kevin Cahill manage to research who owns Britain?
Well, what turns out, I mean, he actually did look at the Doomsday Book. He went that far back. But he's also, over the years, there's been quietly quite a lot of research done. There was one back in the mid-1800s, I think it was 1827, where there was a big survey done, and he's actually dug this out from the archives. And I think his task has been pretty difficult, but what he's managed to do in his book, Who Owns Britain, which is about 50-50, I mean, half of it is a sort of polemic, writing about land ownership and how it's happened. Yeah. But the other half of it is a gazetteer, and it's quite a handy thing to sort of, you know, stick in the boot of the car, really, because you end up in a certain part of the country and you think, well, what is it, you know, who owns this county?
So it's sort of a unique tome then.
It is, yeah, and it's actually, it's apparently at the end of 2012, it's coming out in a second edition because he's updated it. Quite a lot of people have helped him and come back to him and said, well, actually there's another big landowner in this county that you didn't know about. And a lot of this stuff is word of mouth. Ultimately, if you want to find out who owns a piece of land and you go to the land registry and they haven't got that piece of land registered, the only way, and this is unbelievable, the only way to find out is to squat the piece of land, to actually start living on it and find out who evicts you. At that point, you can actually find out who owns the land.
They say word of mouth. I've spoken on various occasions with various people over time, and the consensus is that it used to be that the Church of England used to own vast amounts of land, or if it wasn't them, it would probably be the royal family. What does the book tell us about these two institutions?
Well, the Church of England have been, a lot of the land has been taken off the church. The church don't own as much as they used to because of Henry VIII and the dissolution of the monasteries. There were little bits of land given around the country to keep individual vicars, but most of the land's been taken off of the church and is now invested in the Crown. Now, the Crown is a massive landowner, the Queen, that is, and obviously that then passes down through generations, as are things like the Dukes. I mean, one of the biggest, the two big traditional feudal landowners near us are south of Bristol, are William Waldegrave and the Waldegrave estate. And then if you go up north into Gloucestershire, it's the Duke of Beaufort and his estate, which is based around badminton. So you've got these big estates still that have been there literally for centuries.
Right. Tell us very briefly, I mean, you mentioned some names when we were speaking earlier about the Duchy of Lancaster, for example.
Well, this is an interesting one, isn't it? The Duke of Lancaster doesn't exist, but the Duchy of Lancaster, which is his estate, does.
So who owns the Duchy of Lancaster?
It's just a company that floats around with no actual owner, but the Queen nominally owns it. So all the profits made from the Duchy of Lancaster, which is a massive, you know, land estate of itself, all go straight to the Queen.
Okay.
And so it's one of those weird things. I think, I'm not absolutely sure, but I think over history, at some point, the Duke of Lancaster did something the monarch didn't like.
Right.
And so the Queen just sort of got rid of the Duke, maybe put him in the Tower or something, and then just took the Duchy of Lancaster for her own use.
There are other sort of slightly conspiratorial Dan Brown-esque names that also pop up. The Knights of Malta and the Order of the Garter.
Well, first, the Knights of Malta are actually a very interesting organisation who are based in Malta. They have embassies all over the world. And guess what? I mean, it's basically just an organisation. It's not really a country. I mean, they are very important in Malta, but they have embassies all over the world, but they don't have to produce any accounts. So it's one of those places.
Do they
do wonder? You do wonder, is this just a money laundering outfit? As for the Order of the Garter, well, that's been going since medieval times. And it's fascinating because there's 26 members of the Order of the Garter. Two of those are the monarch and the heir to the throne.
So, and briefly, does this relate to the ownership of land in Britain?
Well, of course, yeah. So because, they're basically surrounding both the Queen and the heir to the throne. So that's the Queen and Prince Charles.
Okay.
And there's 26 of them. So you've got what you might call a sort of little group or even a two covens surrounding the monarchy. And that's been like that with the Order of the Garter since medieval times.
Okay, well, we must press on, unfortunately. You also briefly mentioned Who Owns the World, and you wanted me just to...
Well, this is Kevin's other book, okay. And this has more recently come to light, that not only does the Queen own all the land in Britain, actually, funnily enough, she owns even freehold land, because if you look at the bottom of your deeds, if you bought your house, you'll find there's a little bit in the small print that says, actually, the Queen can have it any time she wants for nothing. So, effectively, the Queen has legal title to all the land in Britain except for Cornwall, which the Prince of Wales has legal title to. So this is a small legal thing that very few people realise.
Okay.
And what Kevin's done with his book, Who Owns the World, is to look at that and also see how much land the Queen actually owns right across the world, the old Commonwealth countries. She owns vast... In fact, it's probably fair to say she's the biggest landowner in the world, although hardly anyone knows
it. Bringing it to home shores, when does Who Owns Britain come out?
Well, the new edition comes out at the end of the year. But just to say, the reason Kevin has got all this information and people have been helping him over the years is because he was working for a couple of decades for the Sunday Times, and has been and still does, on the Sunday Times rich list. And of course, one of the things that you find as you get towards the super rich is that they find all sorts of ways of hiding their wealth, so they don't even appear on the rich list. So if you're the super wealthy, you're not even going to be on the rich list, because all your wealth is squirreled away.
Well, Tony Gosling, thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
I'd like to welcome to the studio Derek Pickup and Anne Kennard. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
You're both involved in town twinning. So, Derek, how did you wind up being involved in town twinning?
Right, well, I'm the chair of the Bristol Tbilisi Association, and Tbilisi is the capital of Georgia, which is in the Caucasus, just the other side of Turkey. And I became involved in 1995 when I was working for Bristol City Council. And the Director of Environmental Services had a letter from his counterpart in Tbilisi, which said, "We've just had a civil war. We've just become independent, having formerly been one of the Soviet states. We're in crisis. You're our twin city. What are you going to do to help us?"
Right, okay.
And the director gave me the letter and said, "You're good at this kind of thing, Derek. I'd like you to do something to help them, but you can't have any money. Go and see what you can do."
Right, and what was your job for Bristol City Council at the time?
At the time, I was a policy officer in the Health and Environmental Services Department.
Okay, so possibly not a huge area of expertise from what I can gather then, if you suddenly told, you know, do something to help Tbilisi.
Well, I used to be responsible for regeneration in Bristol.
Okay.
So I think that might have been one of the reasons why he gave it to me. So I was used to making things happen.
Okay. Anne Kennard, over to you. What was your history and what were you doing before you wound up?
I became chair of Bristol Hanover Council. I joined the committee in 1996 and became chair in 2000. But Bristol Hanover Council is one of the oldest twinnings in the country. It was set up in 1947, same year as Bristol Bordeaux Association. And it's been running ever since. And we're celebrating our 65th birthday this year, as it were. But it may seem slightly odd that it should be set up between those two cities because Bristol's a port and Hanover isn't, and there doesn't seem to be very much that links them. But in fact, what happened in 1947 was somebody came back from the British Army, came back to Bristol and said, told the city council that the children in Hanover were unable to go to school because they had no shoes. It was 1947 winter, mm-hmm. was so bad, and there were people dying of starvation as well, but the children were unable to go to school. So there was a decision taken to collect shoes to take over to Hanover.
Yeah.
And so there was a group of five men, a goodwill mission it was called, who went over, members of the city council and a professor of German, August Kloss from Bristol University, and the youth officer, I think. And okay. Anyway, five of them went over and took these shoes as a gesture of friendship to Hanover. And they were absolutely, well, what we would call today, blown away in Hanover by only 2 years after the war, you know, that this should happen.
So how common was town twinning up to that point? Did it exist pre-war?
I don't think it did at all, no. Not in any official way, anyway.
So where did it originate from? Where did it sort of start? Was it just sort of come out of the post-war environment with cities?
I think it did, yes. Yes,
I mean,
as a sort of reconciliation thing, I think it's happened. Because in the same year, I think, or around the same time, the Oxford were linked with Bonn, Reading were linked with Dusseldorf. I'm only speaking of the German ones at the moment, obviously.
So was Germany the most sort of popular country for Britain to be twinned with, or is that too much of a generalisation?
That's probably too much of a generalisation, and I wouldn't like to. Yes,
I think France and Germany started with immediately after the Second World War, which was part of the movement of. It said that, you know, you need to form friendships and get to know people. If you were to stop things like war happening. So at that time, it was very much, how can you develop friendships between peoples in different countries?
So what did you know about Tbilisi and Georgia, Derek, before you wound up getting this job?
Well, it's not a job. It's something that I do as a hobby, just as Anne does with Hanover.
Well, yeah.
Not a lot. All I remember, when I was a student, I spent some time being a volunteer in a kibbutz in Israel. And we had a lot of Russians who'd just come out of Russia, because they just started allowing the Jews out. And like the British used to make jokes about the Irish, the Russians always used to make jokes about the Georgians, about these people who lived in the mountain, high up in the Caucasus Mountains, in the middle of nowhere. And so all I'd heard was that it was this country somewhere in the Caucasus.
Okay.
And that was all I knew about it.
So what was it like when you first arrived? You went on a visit. When would that have been?
Well, that would have been 1996, because once the city councillor said, try and do something, I thought, well, first of all, I have to find out where this place is and what links have we got. And I found that we had a Bristol Tbilisi Twinning Association that tried to make things happen between the two cities. And I found out we'd just exchanged ambassadors between Britain and Georgia. So one of the first things I did was phone up the Georgian embassy to talk to the Georgian ambassador.
Well, okay. And what was that like? Did he speak English very well? Was there a bit of a cultural clash? Was it easy
to
do?
No, his English was very good, but he spent 5 years, I think, working in Australia. So he'd worked in various countries for the Soviet Union.
I guess to cut to the chase, in a way, some people don't really know a lot about town twinning and might think this is just sort of a good way for people from both councils to meet up and have a bit of a, you know, slap up meal and appreciate each other a bit. So what do you feel you've achieved, if you like? How has Bristol and Tbilisi benefited, if you like?
Well, I mean, Bristol first became twinned in 1988, and not an awful lot happened because what was happening in terms of the breakup of the Soviet Union, there was a lot of turmoil across then what was Georgia. So it wasn't really possible to do official twinning projects. And you had people in the voluntary sector were doing things, particularly artists in Bristol were going back and forth, but there was nothing official really happening. And it wasn't until sort of 95, 96 when things started to settle down. And then when Tbilisi got in touch with Bristol, it was because they seriously wanted help. And it wasn't help in terms of friendship. It was help in terms of economic development. They had a whole range of environmental problems. They wanted to know, how could we give them some positive advice and help? So it was on that basis that we started to talk to them and develop projects.
And how successful do you think you've been in that? What do you sort of hope for over the next 10 years, say?
Well, I think in the last 15 years, we've been very useful in forming links, in trying to exchange know-how. Also, when we first had problems, we were doing things like we were helping them with aid, things like ambulances. We sent them out waste vehicles, hospital equipment, medical supplies. But that very quickly, as they started to get back on their feet, that developed more into things like know-how, so links between the hospitals, between the universities.
Okay, and so you'd hope that would continue and deepen over time.
Yes, and more recently, we've now started looking at the whole area of economic development and how you can get companies to link up.
Okay, I'll pass over to Anne. What do you feel that you've achieved from sort of toing and froing from Hanover?
Well, I wouldn't say that I've personally toed and froed that much. I mean, I think that it's a very different twinning to that with Tbilisi, because being set up in 1947 in the spirit of reconciliation, the most important thing about it was the friendship between the two cities, and particularly to involve the young people. Mm-hmm. And that's in our constitution now. We give small grants to young people to exchange between the two cities, you know, youth clubs and scouting groups and the odd choir and drama groups and that kind of thing. But for many, many years, there were a very large number of school exchanges between the two cities, not always necessarily kids that were learning German, but many of them were, where they were learning German here and learning English in Germany. Unfortunately, due to the way that, the English have always been so hopeless at learning languages, and the recent governments have actually downgraded the situation with, as regards languages in schools, so that very few children are actually carrying on to do any languages as far as GCSE, let alone A-level or university. The whole thing is now really in very different. Okay, so there are only a couple of school exchanges left.
What very briefly, do you feel that you would hope to achieve over the next sort of 5-10 years if you're still involved?
Well, we continue to have cultural exchanges. We will be going, in fact, in a couple of weeks, 30 people, including half of that is a choir, in fact, Westbury Singers, who are linking up with their opposite numbers, Cantonova, in Hanover, and the other half are straight members of Bristol Hanover Council.
Okay, so we wrap up, I guess, towards the end of the interview. It does strike me that you've spoken about Tbilisi as appealing to you for requirements that are, you know, really basic. And obviously, Hanover has long since advanced and is at a completely different level. Initially, the link-up would have been in the post-war sort of environment. Do you, Anne, think that there is a sort of a connection between the two twinnings, despite the incredibly different nature of them?
Well, there is a connection in the sense that I think the twinnings are really important in terms of civil society, you know, the whole links between people on the ground. You can just ignore what the politicians are doing. People on the ground do very different things and do talk to each other, even if their countries don't get on very well.
Yeah.
But the two twinnings are very different. They started out with different, you know, for different reasons. And so I'm not sure that there is a link in terms of the way they function.
Because how do you coordinate, Derica? How do you manage to coordinate such a huge variety of different town twinnings? Or who does?
Well, we have 7 twin cities in Bristol, and we all got together and there was a decision made that we ought to have somebody who tries to pull everything together.
Hmm.
So we have Alex Hughes, who works for what's called the Bristol International Twinning Association, which was actually set up by all the other twinning associations. And he's the one person who's employed to work with us to try and put some continuity and try and get us to liaise a bit with each other.
Okay, I noticed you also used the word employed. So he's the only one who's employed. Does that imply he's the only one who's paid to do it, or are you all paid for your jobs?
Yeah, no, we're not paid at all. What Derek just described happened at the point where the City Council decided that they didn't want to run the twinnings themselves from inside the council house, if you like.
Right.
And so they give a grant to the Twinnings Association, most of which is actually used in order to help the coordinator to coordinate the twinnings, but he operates as a separate issue.
So effectively, when people go to and fro or whatever, that's all you're all funding that yourselves?
Yeah. We all pay for ourselves. We're not on jollies, I do assure you. I mean, you will find us on the City Council website, mm-hmm. because it is still to do with the City Council, but we do the legwork mostly, and you'll find all the websites in the twinning section of the council website.
And how do you feel, Derek, that Bristol is doing in town twinning relative to other cities and places in the UK?
I think Bristol's done very well. We've won a couple of major awards from Europe to do with town twinning. And I think a lot of people look up to Bristol and look at what we've done. And because we've got a coordinator, a lot of other cities are starting to follow that example, i.e. somebody who can sort of pull things together and add some focus for what's happening. And certainly more recently, Bristol City Council has become interested because the world is becoming a smaller place. Mm. Because there's economic problems around the world, people are looking for more partners to do business with.
Is it too difficult, for example, to do a town turning with somewhere where there is great conflict? For example, I'm thinking of all the countries that have experienced the Arab Spring, for example, places where there might be conflict at the moment. Would that be somewhere where you wouldn't be able to think about town twinning? Or
I think it's incredibly difficult to organise twinning where there's conflict, because there's always the potential for danger, and you don't tend to send people into places where they may not come back. So you tend to look for more stable environments. Okay, I think that's very difficult.
What was that like, Derek, for you particularly, in bearing in mind what's been going on about Georgia, and what's been going on in Georgia between them and Russia? Because I noticed at the beginning when I asked, you said that they'd initially come to you having gained their independence.
Yes, but when I went over there in 96 for the first time, all the problems they had stopped. The civil war they had stopped. Everything was very peaceful. It was very different from the way it is today. Over 15 years, they've developed enormously. Mm. But you feel very safe there. Even going there a couple of weeks after the short war they had with Russia, it felt very secure.
Okay. Well, at that point, I think I'd better just ask one of you, or you can fight over it, to remind people where the website is that people can find out more.
Well, all the seven twinnings have their own websites, and they can all be found on the Bristol City Council website. So just Google Bristol City Council and you will find a section on the twinnings there, and all seven are easy to find.
Anne Kennard and Derek Pickup, thank you very much for coming in.
Pleasure.
It's nice to have Rosemary Dunn back in the studio.
Hello, it's lovely to be here too, John.
Okay, in previous weeks you've mentioned you were doing something in Hay on Wye, reading your poetry.
Yes.
Did it go well?
Well, it did go well, and in spite of the Jubilee and the sunshine that didn't turn up. So, yes, not quite as packed as it was last year, but still lots of fun.
Good, good.
Thank
you. What have you got for us this week?
Okay, well, this is one that I did at Hay. I've been watching The Voice and enjoying it with Tom Jones.
Despite the plummeting ratings and all the dreadful stuff.
Oh, yeah, I still love it. Okay, it's brilliant. And Tom Jones, in particular, with all his name dropping, which kind of got me thinking, what would it be like if Elvis was still alive? So this is called Elvis Needs a Hip Replacement. If our dead icons hadn't died, if today they were alive, what would they be doing now? Too much grinding of the pelvis has finally done in Elvis. He needs a hip replacement pronto, even though he has gone tonto by adopting Michael Jackson and his genetically cloned grandson. While James Dean is on the telly as a private dick with a fat belly, kind of Kojak and Columbo combined, and Marilyn's on the front of this month's Time. Mark Bolan tours the East with Noddy Holder and The Sweet, while the rumours do abound that David Bowie is in town and Marilyn Monroe is so sublime. Jim Morrison has got farty, has been chucked from the X Factor party, caught trying to set Tom the Voice Jones on fire. Jim is threatening to sue Michael Hutchence from In Excess, Wouldn't You, for trying to look like him, and for Paula, who Jim says is dire, but I like Paula Yates. John Lennon's won the Booker, just got married to a hooker, says that Marilyn is his muse and has absolutely refused to reform with that whinging git Paul McCartney. John, Janis Joplin, Hendrix, too, are the beat poets of the new age through the internet and cyberspace man. They win intercity poetry slams, whooping Roger McGoughs and Pams. But Muhammad Ali is proving tough to beat. And Marilyn Monroe is so neat. Yes, Marilyn, who is sublime and who died before her time, has another sold-out run at that theatre, the trendy one. Some of the good do die young. Thank you.
Thank you. I think you got in pretty much every single deceased.
I'm sure I missed some.
Yeah, you must have. Yes. Okay. We'll see if you can find some more.
The ones I wanted. Yes, I could do an update, couldn't I?
Yeah. Rose Redun, thank you very much.
And thank you for having me.
I'd like to welcome Tim Burrow to the studio. Hello.
Hi.
What have you been up to? What have you got for us this week?
Well, I've been learning some bottleneck sliding. I've done a poem about playing bottleneck sliding, why people play it, and then I'm going to play a little bit.
Okay.
So I want to sing of the broken heart with a bottleneck slide, knife poised sharp as it slides over the taut strings, strung like a bow with an arrow aimed at the soft, beating breast. The moaning metal becoming the grief of a jilted lover, tears falling from the sad singing strings. The guitar has become a hole through to the soul of loneliness.
Thank you very much. Have you got anything coming up, like public performances, and people can come along and...
Last Sunday of the month, Under the Stars, there's my Folk Wind and Whimsy night, so if anyone wants to come along and play,
okay,
recite a poem, play a song, you know, please drop in, or just drop in to support and keep music live.
For listeners who don't know, that is the cafe bar Under the Stars, which is by the Falafel Van, right in the centre of town. Fresh out of a coffin from Transylvania, we've got Jeff Sparks for the What's On Guide and the Song of the Week.
Thank you, John. Hello, this is a What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 22nd of June, Will and the People will be performing with support from Old Colours at the Victoria in Victoria Road, Swindon. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. Also on 22nd of June, Eddie Martin will be performing at the Fiddlers in Wellway Street at Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present The Wurzels. This group formed in 1966 and are still performing and recording to this day. In their career, they have released 9 albums under the name Edge Cutler and The Wurzels, and since Edge Cutler's death, 20 albums under the name The Wurzels. This is from the album Nevermind the Bullocks, Here's The Wurzels, and it's a cover of the song Country House, originally by Blur.
Welcome to my little love nest in the country. And so the story begins. City dweller, successful feller, thought to himself, oops, I got a lot of money. All in a rat race, terminally. A professional cynic, but me heart's not in it. I'm paying the price of living life at the limit. Caught up in the centuries, hangs all your E. It brings all in. At the country, takes all manner of pills, piles out of those pills in the country. Like an animal farmer, lots of rural charm in the country. It's got a morning glory, life's a different story. Everything's going jack and jolly. In touch with his own mortality. He's reading Balzac, knocking back Prozac, helping and feels wonderfully bland. Oh, it's the century's remedy for the faint at heart, a brand new start. Oh, he lives in an house, it's a very big house in the country. He's got a bomb on his chest, so he needs a lot of rest in the country. He don't drink smoke, life takes herbal baths in the country. Is a stupid, I'm doing my best tonight. I'll show you. Blow, blow me out. What do I blow me out for? It's good enough for the world, isn't it? Oh, we lived in a house, it's a very big house in the country. Watching animal repeats in the food he eats in the country. Takes all manner of pills, piles animals, pills in the country. Looking at animal farmer, lots of rural charm in the country. Lived in a house, it's a very big house in the country. Chess, so we need a lot of rest in the country. We don't race much life, take herbal baths in the country. And you come to the world on an animal farm in the country. Incidents, turn it against in the country. He's got a ball on his chest, so we need a lot of rest in the country. Let him go. We don't race much life, take herbal baths in the country. And you come to the world on an animal farm in the country.
That was The Wurzels with Country House from the album Nevermind the Bullocks, Here's The Wurzels, which was released in 2002. Into Saturday 23rd of June, Beth Hart will be performing with support from Martin Harley at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £20 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. Finally, on 23rd of June, Nyon Maiden will be performing at The Horn in Victoria Street, St Albans. Tickets are £6 in advance, £7 on the door, and doors open at 8 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Courtesy of Mike Noyce, we have another sofa session in which somebody comes down and plonks their behind or on his sofa for a bit of a chat, and then we hear a tune. This week, Adu Lighton interviews the band Gorgonzola, and then they play one of their tunes.
On the sofa today is Gorgonzola with Invisible Dave.
Hello.
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 Hello, my name is Gorgonzola.
I am Peter Gog.
Dave.
He is Dave.
I gather your mission statement is to make the world a happier place. How do you make Dermot Appleyer plays?
Well, we do it through our music. We are always very influenced by the Irishman, Daniel O'Donnell, and we like Gareth Gates as well. But it's difficult to explain how it first come about, because when you first see Gareth Gates and you watch his video for Suspicious Minds, you see the song. It's a very sad song. It's a song about a man and his girlfriend. She is crazy. She is crazy and paranoid, and it's driving him mad, but he loves her so much he cannot leave her. And so it's tearing him apart. And you see the man in the song, and he's grinning. You think, what is wrong with you? Do you not understand what is happening? But when It's not happiness.
This not happiness. Rolled over your happiness tractor. Superior potato.
Exactly. But that's what I'm saying. When you realise that Gareth, he makes the song a weeny bit happier. And it shows that in the depths of despair, there is a little bit of hope.
Not as good as Superior Potato.
Of course not, but we must try.
How do you do that?
I'd make our songs happier.
Yes.
Peter will tell you. Peter, you tell.
We are inspired by Superior Tractor. We build song to be functional yet rugged. We are building song now since 1992 on the same sequencer.
But no, we make the beats a bit more upbeat. We like to bring
the stirring spirit of bees.
That's true, yes. And we bring the organ in, the Hammond sound. It's nice, it's a warm sound.
It's not Hammond, it's Yamaha.
It's Korg, actually. And then we have the kazoo solos. And the kazoo, you cannot not smile when there is a kazoo in the mixer. And Dave, he will tell you about kazoos.
Kazoo, for me, is life. When I play the kazoo, I connect with the cosmos. You know, the is like. So when I play kazoo, like the.
Dave is session musician. Do not ask him question.
Like the wings of a bee, man.
Dave, no, stop.
Dave is good for question because he brings. What is it you bring? You have the solo, you bring the kazoo, but you try to recreate the sound of the guitar with the kazoo. He gets a man who play guitar, he try and recreate it, but he bring a little smile.
I try and feel what the guy is playing when he's playing the guitar, and I try and tune into that, and then channel that through the kazoo, man.
Dave, you're embarrassing us. Stop talking.
I'm sorry.
Do you make any of your own music?
At the moment, no.
Yes. I compose new Roldovian national anthem. I play for you on Polyvox Russian stylophone.
Stop!
No, get to good bit. Good bit, come now.
No, you don't put that too near the microphone, you silly fool.
This is like contemporary.
It is contemporary, but yes, we make some of our own music, but at the moment there are so many songs out there that are angry or sad, and we must make them all happier to make the world happier.
Okay.
We spread the love.
We're going to play one of your songs now. Could you tell us all about it, please?
Well, we are going to play the song Anarchy in the UK, which was originally by the Sex Pistols, but they were very shouty. And anarchy means different things to different people. And some people, you say, it's doing what you like, but what you like could be spreading their love. What do you say anarchy is?
Is like strong thighs of Russian woman won in chess match.
Exactly. And Dave, what do you think, anarchy?
But the bees, man, the bees are free. They don't mind. Why'd
you ask him?
Do their thing, man.
He just say bees.
But he like bees. He used to live with beekeeper. But bees are great because of anarchy, because you look at a beehive and it's everywhere. There's bees all over the place. And some looking around, all they want is sex. And the other one, she gives the babies. And then the other one, they get all the honey and the pollen. And it's all these things at once.
Only one of them gets laid, though.
That's true, but that's quite
cool. That's not my idea of anarchy.
But there we go. That is the song, Anarchy in the UK. We make it a bit happier for our people. Here it is.
Christ, and I am an anarchist. I don't know what I want, but but I know how to get it. I want to destroy the passers-by, because I wanna be an IKEA. No dog for there. Sometime, and maybe I give a wrong time, stop a traffic line. Your future dream is a shopping scheme, because I wanna be an IKEA. It's in the city. What you want, I use the best, I use the rest, I use the enemy, I use anarchy, because I wanna be anarchy. It's the only way to be. Take it away, Invisible Dave.
Was Anarchy in the UK by Gord and Sola. Do you have any gigs lined up?
Not as yet. We like to have some gigs maybe coming up soon, but not yet. We're thinking maybe do open the mic to start with.
They are not giving us gigs either.
Well, we might find someone who likes us.
I know a farmer with a barn.
This had better not be about bees.
No bees. I think he has a barn. But is the barn big enough to hold 300 people?
It could hold a chicken, a sheep, so maybe the occasional cow? Or
I tell you, no, ask him questions.
I say. But yes, if you do like us and you want to give us a gig, we can be contacted on Gorg and Zola, that's GORGANDZOLA, at hotmail.co.uk.
We should be with Zamel. He's no communist-killing American aggressor.
They are all owned by the same people these days. It's all the same. Whether it's Google...
Oh, it's China own America.
China own everybody.
Ah.
Yes. And if you like it, we'll soon have a Facebook page called Gorgonzola. And at the moment, if you go to musiboo.com/ftop, EFFTOP, our producer has put a couple of songs of us on there.
Gorgonzola, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much to Mike Noyce and also to Ali Lighton and the band Gorgonzola, of course. Oh, well, that's all we've got time for this week. So thank you very much to Derek Pickup and Anne Kennard for coming in and being interviewed. Thank you also to Rose Redun, Tim Burrows. Thank you also to Tony Gosling and Anthea Page for their contributions. And also to Michael Noyce and Adio Lighton and Gorgonzola, of course, not forgetting. We also had Jeff Sparks providing the Watson Guide and the Song of the Week. Dialect recommends, of course, we said earlier, the volunteer-run Bristol Billy Watch Helpline, which is aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number for that is 01454 318 753. Dialect is produced by the Bristol Radio Co-op, which is a volunteer-run thing, and that means anyone can contribute. You're out there listening, if you're interested and you're living in the Bristol area, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. You can also find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Thank you very much to the engineer, Michael Noyce, and the producer for this week was Tony Gosling. I'm John Peters Coleman, wishing you a very good week. So from all the team here in our Queen Square studio in Bristol, thank you for listening and goodbye.
Towers made of steel, but that won't connect heaven and the ground. These days, money, not love, is the thing that makes this world go round. We got no more faith in our foundation, and space ain't strong. Just an illusion, and one day soon Babylon is gonna fall. Yes, it is. Oh yeah, Babylon is gonna fall. It's coming down. Take a look around. Why aren't we people living in unity? Self-serving humans will always be indulging our humanity. We've got no more faith in our foundation, and this base ain't strong at all. This world is just an illusion. Babylon is gonna fall. It's going down. Yeah, Babylon is gonna fall. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Hey, got no more faith in our foundation, and this base ain't strong at all. This world. Babylon is gonna fall. Yes, it is. Whoa, Babylon is gonna fall. It's coming down, down, down. Yeah, I see it fall. Babylon is gonna fall. Babylon is gonna fall.